BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello you! This is the podcast of Inside Science from BBC Radio 4, first broadcast on the 23rd of July 2020. I'm Adam Rutherford. 80% of this green and pleasant land is within 1 kilometre of a road. The UK has the 12th highest road density in the whole world. The impact on wildlife is, shall we say, complex, and we're taking a close look at the first study to assess the effect of roads on the birds of Britain. But first, we're picking up on a theme from last week's programme about how scientific research makes it into the public domain and into the headlines. Traditionally, this is how it works. Scientists do their science, they write up the results, send it to a journal, whereon it gets peer-reviewed. That is, other experts check it, scrutinise it, criticise it, and if all goes well, the paper gets published. The journal might then send out a press release, and journalists will take a look and decide whether it's worth reporting on. Now, there are a million things wrong with this process, but that's the way it is. Except in the last few years, a new system has emerged where results get shared online before peer review. These are called preprints. And this is not inherently a bad thing. It means that there's potentially a tier of scrutiny that happens before the formal editorial process, which serves to make the research even better. Now, why am I telling you this? If this all seems a little bit nerdy for the general public, I would normally agree, until COVID-19 happened. The interest and desperation to find out about this horrid virus and work towards treatments and a vaccine is so urgent that a huge proportion of the science that you are seeing in the news about the virus and about COVID are from studies that are preprints. That is, they haven't been peer-reviewed yet. This doesn't mean that they are wrong, but it doesn't help them to be right. And with the understandable clamour to get new COVID research out there as quickly as possible, what you are seeing in the press may not be as robust science as you might see in times when there isn't a global pandemic. So what does this all mean? Have preprints become the new normal for science? What impact are they having on the way society understands science? Fiona Fox is the Chief Executive Officer of the Science Media Centre, which is an independent press office for the scientific community. Fiona has written a blog about the problems with the preprint system, which is much older than you might think. She told me why the pace has suddenly quickened.
Well, the reason that we've become interested in them just in the last few years is that they haven't been around a long time for medical research and clinical research. The truth is that gravitational waves are fascinating, endlessly fascinating, but don't tend to impact on whether or not you get vaccinated, whether or not you think e-cigs are a substitute for smoking, etc. So what is new is that it's only really in the last couple of years that you have seen journals and other people setting up preprint servers for medical research and clinical research. And it's very much public interest research.
And that is a key distinction, because these preprint servers, which are basically just websites that host scientific papers, for physics, for astronomy, they've been used for 30 years and it's uncontroversial and people love them. And in the life sciences since 2013. But it is really that it's now medical information, and particularly during the COVID pandemic, that this has come to the fore as being potentially problematic.
Absolutely. And I think two things have changed. One, more and more papers are coming through on COVID, which is of huge global public interest. So suddenly these preprint servers are a way that scientists could share their finding with other scientists and have those discussions with other scientists in the field. We'll thrash out how to make them better before they get out into the public. Now you've got both members of the public and also journalists scouring these preprint servers, putting in the words COVID, and suddenly findings which are very preliminary, have not been checked, are not the best version of themselves, are in global newspapers as facts. And even though journalists are getting better at pointing out this is research which hasn't yet been published, I'm not sure whether the public make that distinction. And that's why we're really concerned about this.
So as the brokers between some working scientists and the public, what is the Science Media Centre's advice on addressing the fact that preprints even exist for dealing with this kind of research?
Well, one of the reasons that I wrote my blog was to really do a big mea culpa in a way and say that the Science Media Centre had worked with the scientific community and press officers to draw up guidelines. And those guidelines were very, very clear that we urged all scientists and science press officers to not publicise. That's a really important word. Obviously, preprints are in the public domain, but what usually gets them to the wider public is a press release, is a press conference, alerting journalists to the fact that this is a significant finding, you should tell the world. So our guidance was to say, do not publicise them because it's raw research, it's not yet been through the checks and balances. And then suddenly, overnight, there have been a deluge of preprints picked up by journalists. And then our dilemma was, are we still going to stick to that guideline and not publicise it and not play any role in publicising it? And to be honest, it was a no-brainer. The role of the Science Media Centre is to improve the quality of science that is reaching the wider public. So to ignore these preprints would be absolutely wrong. So what we did, in fact, was to start seeking third-party comments on those so that journalists knew which were good preprints and which were poor preprints, in the same way that we've done for many, many years on published papers.
Okay, now I want to bring in Jonathan Reed now into the conversation. He's a senior lecturer in biostatistics at Lancaster University, focuses on the evolutionary dynamics of infectious diseases, part of the modelling group that advises the SAGE Committee on the pandemic. So I imagine, Jonathan, you've had a busy last couple of months.
It's been somewhat hectic, yeah.
Now, when did preprints become a thing in your field, and what was your reaction to them?
Yeah, I became aware of preprints really a couple of years ago when they started to become more common in bioanalysis and medical science. And to be honest, I kind of originally looked at them with a little bit of dismay and disgust and didn't really think they should be part of the scene, really. Everything should wait for peer review, and that's the gold standard, and we should stick to it. And certainly never cite a preprint in a published paper. That seemed completely wrong to me. And I have to admit, I've changed my mind now, particularly with the COVID situation. You know, speed sometimes trumps some of those concerns.
What was it that made you change your mind initially?
I guess back in 2014, we were doing some work on the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. And I was a little bit disappointed in the way that politics and the way some of the big top journals were treating submissions and leading to delays. That seemed to me to be stymieing the information getting out to the people that really needed it. And I recall at the time thinking, next time something like this happens, I'll just blog the results, you know, and then let the world decide. And in some ways, preprint servers aren't quite like that, but it does enable you to sort of get your work out there very quickly.
But I suppose the key difference for a working scientist is that the purpose of preprints was to share results for peer reviews, yeah, so that other scientists could talk about them, rather than what's actually happened, especially with COVID, which is that journalists are now reporting from preprints.
Yeah, exactly. And as I'm sure you know, the way that we tend to write scientific papers is they're not particularly clear usually, and the devil is usually in the detail. And I pity the public reading things on places like MedArchive and seeing all the raw guts of scientific writing and trying to cut a path through it to make sense.
Fiona, during this current pandemic, demand for new scientific research has just gone meteoric. And understandably so, because we're desperate to understand the problem and also to generate potential cures. But how significant has preprints been in the scientific information that you, the Science Media Centre, are putting out there?
Very significant. They're not all preprints. Some of them, you have to remember that not all science gets out through journals. So it's been a combination of preprints. One of the things that I think people may not know is that a lot of the imperial studies, which are cited as being one of the reasons that we went into lockdown, all of that data was published on the Imperial College website. So there are various ways, and some of the things that have been coming out, for example, the Royal Society have been looking into many aspects of it, like face masks, etc. And they are just reports that come out of the Royal Society. So one way or another, that demand for information and understanding of this virus, much of it, a significant proportion, has been before peer review. And now, I suppose, obviously, we're now 4 or 5 months into this. We are seeing even some of the studies that we ran press conferences on, which were preprints, are now finally being published in journals. And interestingly, are probably not getting the kind of media coverage that you would normally get in a major medical journal, because of course they've already been well covered by the media.
Now, John, one of the preprints which highlights the problem that we're talking about here was a modelling paper that you put out back in January, right at the very beginning
of the current pandemic. So at that time, it was just a novel coronavirus from Wuhan that we were already beginning to talk about on Inside Science. What did that paper actually say?
So the paper was looking at the basic reproduction number of the virus in Wuhan, this magic R value that tells you whether the epidemic's growing or not and gives you some estimation of how easy it is to control it. And we made an initial estimate and revised that a few days later. But essentially, that information was saying that this clearly is a fast-growing epidemic. It's potentially very hard to stop, to control. You have to do a lot of effort to control it, and it's clearly got pandemic potential. So we felt it was really important to try and get that information out as quickly as possible.
And of course, everyone in the universe and their dog knows about the R number now, but that original paper had it at 3.8.
That's right.
What was the reaction to that? Because that seems very high.
Yeah, so Twitter in various places went a bit crazy on it. Some of the tabloid media picked up on our perhaps unwise projections as to how many cases there would be in Wuhan within a month. And of course, they picked up the sort of the upper estimate of our calculations and ran with that. And now it doesn't seem that extreme to say, oh, there may be 350,000 cases within a month. I think we've all got used to living with the idea that big numbers are easily possible with this virus. But back at the time, it made the headlines.
I suppose this talks to the fundamental problem here, which is that science is always conditional, always it needs to be validated by other research and publications and so on. And yet you can jump on that, or the media can jump on something without all the caveats and say, holy smoke, this is going to be a disaster. And I suppose that is exactly what you experience when you put out some valid research and then the media went nuts for you.
Yeah, that's right. The global media were trying to get hold of me every 2 minutes.
Fun? Did you enjoy that?
Not really. I'd probably let them all down by taking the phone off the hook.
I'm sure that Fiona would definitely not approve of that behaviour in a scientist.
Well, we were actually hoping that the journalists wouldn't pick it up. That was my first experience of a preprint that was picked up globally by the media. And I think that was probably just as much of a shock to Jonathan as it was to us.
Certainly was.
Prior to that, journalists were just not scouring preprint servers. They were too busy. There is ample science stories around. So I think our first thing was to try and not publicise it in any way on the basis that it was a preprint and we would wait for it to be published. And we learned very quickly, and I think it was a good lesson to learn, it's not going to be like that during a pandemic. They are good scientists. This is good data. It is a preprint, so it may well go on to be corrected, but we need to ensure that the media are covering it as well as possible. So we sought third-party comments on it. And indeed, we talked to the authors who alerted us to the fact that one of their estimates needed to be revised and they were going to spend a day or so revising it. And we were able to tell the journalists that. So we knew we were in different territory, but we were able to operate.
And John, what happened once you had published on the preprint? And, you know, if you were going to do it all over again, God forbid that there is another pandemic similar, what would you do differently?
What would I do differently? Very hard question to answer. I think in those sort of situations where potentially a new infectious disease has emerged and we need to know really quickly, because epidemics are exponential processes and any delay really costs you, I think there's a real need to be as quick as possible in reasonably good quality analysis and to get the information out. So being able to say what the R0 value was, that basic reproduction number, and say that it had clear pandemic potential at the time was really important to alert the world. And so I think I would do the same again next time, if there's a next time.
So you've switched round from being initially deeply opposed to preprints as a concept to having gone through this pretty torturous process in COVID, but you're still a fan.
Yep, that's the scientific method, isn't it? Changing your mind.
Yes, and I suppose the real question that falls out of this from a science publishing point of view, or the culture of science point of view, is, well, what is the value of journals? If you can publish on a preprint and you can have your peers comment on it and you can modify the paper as a result of this process, do you need to subsequently publish this research in a journal?
Yeah, good question. So I think one of the limitations to going down that route is a reticence of scientists generally to publicly critique each other's work. Certainly in some of the open access journals, there's been the option to leave comments for a very long time now, and almost no comments are made. And I think if we had a culture that was a little bit more open and accepting of criticism, in the public domain of each other, as long as it's all fair and above board, then I think that might be the way to go.
So, Fiona, how has this whole landscape shift in how we get science from bench to the public, how has it changed the way the Science Media Centre works, or how you communicate, how you facilitate that science communication?
Well, it has changed during COVID because we have accepted the need for speed. And I totally accept Jonathan's point. If I was advising him what to do again, I would also say do the same again. That was important data that needed to be in the public domain. My view, however, would be that we must not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. I just don't want us to go back to thinking there is no room for journals or publication. There was a really well tried and tested system of the process by which you get new scientific findings to the wider public. And that system allowed for the best possible, most accurate reporting. And I just don't think anybody in the UK, not least the public at the moment on COVID, are well served by information that is rushed out, that is not checked, that is not the best version of itself, and that will confuse them even further and may indeed be wrong. And I know journals don't always protect against wrong information, but they are better than nothing.
So it seems to me that though this is very subject specific. So in the past, I've heavily relied on papers published in preprint servers and have subsequently followed them up when they made it into academic journals. And what I've found in one particular area, which is ancient DNA research and not as pressing as infectious diseases, is that they didn't change at all. And therefore, the role of the journal seems to be entirely superfluous to getting the science out there.
So I think certainly my experience of looking at medical science preprints and the final version is that enough of them are just toned down. They are just more measured and a bit less excitable than they were when I first saw them. And when it comes to medical findings and research, which actually impacts on the way the public behave, I think we do need the most accurate measured findings in the public domain. So I think this is two discussions. Is preprint a good thing for open science and for the scientific community? Yes, without a doubt. Is preprint important in epidemics like COVID-19? Yes, and we've seen all the benefits of getting that data out quickly. Should we carry on publicising preprints after COVID is over so that every single public health and clinical finding reaches the public in its rawest form before it's been checked? I really don't want to see that.
Okay, Jonathan, let me give you the last word on this as a working scientist. What happened to that preprint that caused the media storm back in January, the R value, and that Fiona said needed to be revised? Did that go on to be published in a journal?
Yeah, well, so I'm ashamed to say it's not actually been published yet. We did submit it back in January to just a medium level journal, and it got rejected after 2 weeks with one of the reviewers' comments saying, well, this is all a bit old now. And then, you know, real life took over. I had to go and get on with teaching, and we were heavily involved in the advisory group for the government, modelling what was going to happen in the UK next. So we never got round to submitting it anywhere else. Hopefully it will be out there soon. We've got an opportunity to submit to a journal as part of a collection of papers that provided evidence from the UK government. So we're optimistic that it'll finally see the light in a fully peer-reviewed form.
Jonathan Reed from Lancaster University, and before that, Fiona Fox from the Science Media Centre. And last week, we were talking to Stuart Ritchie about his new book, Science Fictions, and he mentioned the most brutal peer review he's come across, just two words, thin gruel, so very Dickensian. Now, we've been soliciting some of your most vicious reviews, and you did not disappoint. James Williams off Twitter got this sick burn. I suggest that the author sticks to writing fluffy opinion pieces for the newspapers and leaves the real research to real researchers. Stephen Montgomery, also on Twitter, got this ecological zinger. Do not waste trees by printing this paper. Ouch. Chris Stringer, probably the most well-known and successful paleontologist in the UK, was put in his place for a study he co-authored this year. Everything we have learned about human evolution and Paleolithic archaeology in the last 25 years shows that it simply isn't like that. My colleague Hannah Fry, she's a mathematician at UCL, was booted into touch for trying to make maths just vaguely understandable. Quote, I think there was a clear intention to use almost street conversation. The consequence of this conversational style is that there are many statements which fail to be sentences. And finally, from circadian rhythm biologist Alex Webb in Cambridge, who received this paper is so bad, I can't be bothered to review it. Wow. Well, send us any zingers or thoughts or sick burns to bbcinsidescience@bbc.co.uk, and I promise to reply in complete sentences.
Roads have a whole variety of potential impacts on wildlife: noise, light, air pollution, chemical pollution, collisions. So I wanted to look at what all of those impacts together might mean for bird populations. So for almost 20,000 sites around Britain, we calculated road exposure as, you know, exposure of each site to roads using the location of all roads within a 5 kilometre radius.
And now in this new paper, which is out this month, you've been looking at this road exposure, so everything to do with roads on British birds. And what have you found?
Findings are quite striking and quite concerning. We analysed populations of 75 bird species at each of these sites, you know, almost 20,000 sites across the whole of Great Britain, and found that for 58 of these, so 77%, their abundance significantly varied with road exposure. So as road exposure increases, we see, you know, changes in their abundance. And of these 58, just over half, so 57%, showed declines in abundance around roads, and the rest, interestingly, showed increases in abundance.
Well, that is a fascinating result in itself, the fact that half of them are going down and half of them are going up. Give us some examples of the species that you're actually looking at, and, you know, who's benefiting and who's suffering as a result of road exposure.
We found that the species that are in lower abundance around roads tend to be those that are nationally rarer, so they have smaller populations across the country. For example, yellow wagtails and green woodpeckers would be two. And those found in higher abundance were those that are more common, such as blackbirds and wood pigeons and house sparrows. And we also found that smaller bodied and migratory birds, for example, chiffchaffs, were more likely to be negatively associated with roads.
And presumably this is the decline of low abundance birds that is accounted for, not just by the fact that they're low abundant, but they're relatively low abundant as a result of road exposure.
Yeah, so if we compare their abundance, you know, close to roads with sites further away from roads, we see relatively lower abundance of these species that are already more rare nationally.
And in the paper, you point out that this is a correlative effect, not necessarily causative. Just talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, so what we have done is looked at, you know, where are the roads, where are the birds, and are there patterns here? Which, yes, there are. But it would need further work to prove a causal link. So are the changes in bird populations directly because of the roads? So what we can show here is that bird abundances do differ around roads, but you'd need more work to really prove that that is a cause. So for example, if you were to do some research around areas where roads have closed or opened, or where traffic levels have varied more or less, then you could start to say more that this is clearly causal. But some of that work has been done in other places around the world. There have been other studies that have done that sort of work, so we can be fairly confident that roads do have an effect on wildlife and birds, and that is most likely what's coming through in our research as well.
Right, but it's not necessarily negative overall. It's negative for some groups of birds and not others. Can you just unpick some of the numbers for us? How many species of British birds did you actually look at?
So we looked at 75 species and found 77% change significantly abundance, with just over half showing declines in abundance and the rest showing increases in abundance. So two examples, one species that we find in increased abundance around road is bullfinches. And we find their abundance was around 23% higher next to a road than in an area far away from roads. Conversely, meadow pipit was a species that was found in reduced abundance near roads, and its abundance was around about 21% lower next to a road compared to away from a road.
So can you actually give us some insight or speculate on why roads can be both negative and beneficial to different bird species?
One of the most important factors, you know, we believe, particularly for birds, is the noise. So you'll know from walking alongside a busy road, it's extremely loud, and this noise travels a long way. You have to go quite far from a road to not be able to hear it. For birds, this noise disrupts their communication and their ability to defend territories, attract mates, communicate with their own offspring. And it also reduces their ability to detect prey or predators, which results in them having to be more vigilant. So, you know, they're looking around more, which decreases their ability to then feed. So coming back to our results, the birds that are found in lower abundance around roads This could be because their survival or breeding success is actually reduced around roads. Or it could be that they are choosing to avoid areas around roads because they can't tolerate the disturbance. And that these species tend to be nationally rarer could mean that roads directly affect their populations, or it could be that they have a reduced ability to adapt to humans in general, which has led to them being both in reduced abundance and also leads them to avoid roads. Birds that are found in higher abundance around roads, however, it may be that they directly benefit from the road. The roads produce grit, heat, food in the form of roadkill, and perches in the form of power lines and fences that tend to run alongside roads. However, it's more likely, I think, that they are probably attracted to the roadside to use the habitat. So we have very few areas of trees, shrubs, hedgerows in Britain, and much of this is alongside roads. So species that can tolerate the disturbance of roads, it would make sense if they're attracted to this habitat. And they may also benefit from the reduced competition due to the lack of rarer species. Importantly, these species may then still suffer the impacts of roads. We know that blackbirds and house sparrows, for example, have high rates of roadkill. But it would appear that overall, they're better able to exist near roads than rarer species.
And we know that the density of roads in the UK is incredibly high. Does the size of the roads or the volume of traffic have an effect on the birds?
Yeah, so we have around 246,000 miles of roads in Britain, and about 87% of these are minor roads, so country roads, B roads and C roads. But the rest are major roads, so A roads and motorways, which have a much higher volume of traffic. They're wider, they're noisier. And I did a sub-analysis looking at how some bird species vary around these roads and found that there were far more negative associations. So 81% of species were negatively associated with major road exposure, which suggests that even for those species that can tolerate the disturbance of being around minor roads, there are thresholds of disturbance beyond which the benefits of being around a road are outweighed by the costs.
And that density must have a significant effect on the distance of the effect of the road, how far it can spread, because there isn't that much territory in this country which is a long way from a road.
No, we have very few areas, unfortunately, that are far away from roads. And strikingly, we found for the species showing negative associations with roads, this effect was detectable up to an average of 700 metres from a road. If we look at the whole of Great Britain, over 70% is within 700 metres of a road. In addition, if we look at protected areas, so SSSIs and nature reserves, over 40% of the total area of them is also within 700 metres of a road.
And a SSSI being a site of special scientific interest.
Scientific interest.
Okay, yeah. Now, what do you think is happening here? Because this looks like selection towards common bird species and away from rare and small ones. What do you think is going on?
So it would seem that roads are disproportionately disadvantaging species that are already rare and perhaps benefiting more common species. This may be because the species that are already rare nationally are rare because they cannot tolerate human disturbance that well, as where the species that are doing better, so pigeons, for example, blackbirds, they are perhaps doing better because they can cope more with human disturbance and the changes that we have caused around the country. So that roads may be benefiting some species at the expense of others, may be leading to what we call simplification of bird communities. So just like in cities, when we see some species like jackdaws and pigeons everywhere, but far fewer unusual birds, perhaps roads are having a similar effect. And this has also been identified as a response to climate change. There's some evidence to suggest that warming environments benefit already common species at the expense of others.
And just to go back to the beginning, you were talking about how this is road exposure, not just noise. But how much of this do you think is down to noise itself?
From other studies that have been done around the world, I would expect that a lot of what we're seeing is responses to noise, particularly given the distances from roads at which we're detecting these possible effects. Collisions do have impacts on some species, so buzzards, barn owls, they can suffer quite high rates of collisions. But for most bird species, it's more likely to be the noise that's having an impact. And in my mind, it's the noise that we should be looking to tackle when we think about mitigation of roads.
So how would we do that? What sort of action could be taken to mitigate against well, the declining bird populations and also noise that's generated by roads?
So there are quite a few things that can be done. One example is to change the road surface slightly. Obviously, there's a plan in the UK to switch to electric vehicles, and this will reduce the noise coming from vehicle engines. But actually, particular high speeds, most of the noise coming from cars is from the interaction between tyres and the road surface. It's not from the engine. So by changing the road surface slightly, for example, using a smaller aggregate material or adding rubber to the road surface, that can reduce the noise quite significantly. Also, noise barriers can be used, but these have to be used carefully so as to not increase the fragmentation impacts of roads. So stopping, you know, terrestrial species from crossing the roads. So they want to be done in combination with underpasses or bridges. Thick tree lines can be used to reduce the noise as well. But, you know, the two most important things really are reducing speed in some areas. So as soon as you reduce the speed, you reduce the sound. But biggest of all, we just need fewer vehicles on the roads and more public transport. That's the number one method of mitigation.
Sophia Cook from Cambridge University, whose PhD Viva is in 4 days' time, if you're listening live. So good luck to Sophia. Though, given the quality of her research, she's been on Inside Science twice now. I'm pretty sure she's going to be Dr. Sophia Cook by this time next week. That is all for today, apart from a nod to Rosalind Franklin, the great scientist whose work paved the way to the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA. She was born 100 years ago, this coming Saturday, that is the 25th of July, and you'll soon be able to see some of her work on the new 50 pence piece. BBC Inside Science at bbc.co.uk is the email if you want to get in touch. Inside Science was produced by Fiona Roberts and Beth Eastwood from the Radio Science Unit. I'm Adam Rutherford. Gareth Mitchell's here next week, and I will see you soon.